Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy Podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. We hope all of our listeners had a lovely holiday period and are ready to get right back into the swing of things. I'm Connor Watts, our automotive and battery analyst, and I'm joined yet again today by Bogdan Avramuta.
Hello everybody.
And we are not joined by our solo analyst Andrew Swantanaris. He is still in an extended holiday period. Firstly, this week, we're going to be talking about a little bit of old news from before the Christmas period, but after when we went on break, which is that Chinese automaker Geely has announced its own fast-charging LFP battery to compete with the likes of CATL and BYD, and it seems to be even better than the originals, released maybe only 6 months ago. We're also going to be talking about the UK's new carbon tax legislation, which looks quite similar to an equivalent to the European Union's carbon border adjustment mechanism, and just see how compatible that is and whether or not there'll be future opportunity for integration. And finally, we're going to be talking about some fossil fuel news in that Angola has decided to leave OPEC Plus, bringing the bloc down to just 12 members. And no, even though it might not have an immediate impact on oil output, it's still pretty big news in the world of fossil fuels, and so we thought we would cover it. First of all, just getting into it, Geely has announced an LFP battery with some incredibly impressive characteristics for, I believe it, the first vehicle it's going to be deployed in. It's already being delivered this year, so it's already into mass production. It's going to be delivered in the Zeekr 007, which I believe is a kind of luxury sedan type, kind of competing with the Tesla Model S, Model 3 type vehicle. It's on an 800-volt architecture. It has an 83% volume utilization statistic, which is very, very high for an LFP battery. Most LFP batteries in the high 60s. The best of the best used to be in the mid-70s. And this one has hit 82%. I have no idea how they've managed that, but it's incredibly impressive. And it increases the efficiency of what is a relatively non-energy-dense battery by kind of reducing the trimmings, as it were. And so it shouldn't have any serious impact on performance. Speaking of, it charges at 4.5C, and Geely claims it can charge 500 kilometers of range in 15 minutes. This is likely using Chinese standards, so knock off 20% for any Americans or Europeans, and you get about 400 kilometers in 20 minutes, or I believe 260 odd miles, 250. Anyways, it's 4.5C, the 100 kilowatt hour version is about 600 kilometers range, I believe. The important thing here, though, is that Geely, weirdly enough, is one of the few Chinese companies really making an effort and seemingly trying to get into the American market in spite of 27% tariffs on any vehicles produced in China. So this isn't just a China and Europe factor. It is a China, Europe, and North America option into the near future. The battery itself can charge at about 500 kilowatts. Now, this isn't incredibly available right now, but in another bit of news, which I believe I covered in the Shorts and Worth Noting section this week, NIO, as part of its NIO Day announcements, announced its newest supercharger standard, which goes up to 650 kilowatts at a charging standard aimed towards the consumer grade as opposed to anything heavy duty. So while we saw Tesla, I believe, becoming the famous one for the megawatt chargers for their Tesla semi-trucks, high charging rates for consumers are also still increasing. So anybody who thought that we'd be sticking with the 350 kilowatt charging and be sorely mistaken, as that's already nearly doubled in the space of about a year and a half. So that is partly what will enable the 400 kilometers in 15 minutes claim. Geely, just in other company news, what has increased its sales goal for this year to, I believe, 1.8 million units. Now, with that kind of the end of this year and the start of this week, we've seen some news surrounding BYD overtaking Tesla as the largest producer of new energy vehicles globally. Now, there's a caveat there. BYD does include plug-in hybrids and hybrids into its sales figures. So while it may have sold 3 million new energy vehicles this year, it only sold 1.6 million BEVs. Only, I know. But this is for Q4 2023, this overtook Tesla's figure, which still broke its own record, as it has done quarterly pretty much in every instance, but it didn't hit its own sales target for the end of the year, just because of pricing issues or whatever other issues Tesla may concoct. So you already have BYD overtaking Tesla, and now Geely is really trying to ramp up its volume manufacture to compete on a reasonably level playing field with it.
So Connor, all these companies that you mentioned, CATL, BYD, Geely, they're all Chinese, right?
Yes, they're.
How does Geely's technology, or rather, where does Geely's technology breakthrough see it in the global battery market reference frame? Because we know about the IRA and the fact that will Geely be able to actually sell to the American market?
They are able to sell to the American market. There isn't a trade embargo on Chinese EV products. It's just immensely difficult from an economic standpoint because of 27% tariffs added to any electric vehicles imported from China. And so Chinese companies do have the option of selling into the American market if they can produce something even more efficient when accounting for these incredibly high tariffs.
Right, so this technological breakthrough still doesn't account for the 27%?
27% tariffs on a consumer purchase.
So the margin is still essentially would be out of the range?
Not necessarily. Now, this isn't a breakthrough in chemistry or raw material costs. It's a breakthrough in charging speed, which is a relatively, or comparatively at least, immaterial customer benefit.
Sure.
It isn't an increase in energy density, which lowers the battery price, which lowers the ticket price. It's something that makes it more desirable for consumers in another manner. Now, as to how it competes internationally, CATL's Shenzhen battery charges at 4C. And so this new battery from Geely, which is already in mass production, does beat CATL's kind of top-of-the-range fast-charging battery. It won't be in as significant a production capacity, which while Geely does have it in mass production, it doesn't produce it anywhere near the scale CATL does. So it's not really a fair comparison. Now, I believe in its announcements it claimed that Geely has been working on this battery for the last 3 years and had something like 1,200 researchers working on it, and they're looking to increase that. CATL is still operating on a much larger scale than Geely. It's operating on a much larger scale than everybody, to be frank. But it will be very good for that competition to, A, just to keep CATL on its toes. It knows it's by far the market leader in the vast majority of instances, and so I doubt it's going to get complacent just because that's not how Chinese companies really do it. They come first, and then they come first for the next 10 years until all of its competition have died off. Then they become complacent. So it's not yet at a time when that's a concern, but it's good to have that little impetus behind it. You know, it's got the fire under its bottom to continue innovating. It's more so, this is horrible news for European battery manufacturers who are only just getting into LFP, and it's the same for the South Korean and Japanese cathode and battery manufacturers, because they've been outdone again by another Chinese company with significant manufacturing capacity that can export into the European market without any significant trade barriers as of yet. When it comes to who European cell manufacturers and OEMs are going to be partnering with in terms of just pure product efficacy, there isn't any European companies, say the ones partnered with the OEMs or owned by incumbent OEMs like PowerCo, ACC, they are not competing on a level playing field with Chinese companies when it comes to LFP batteries. It's just not even in the question at the moment, particularly when it comes to fast charging, which is still seen as an issue of LFP in the West, despite innovations being made in the East. I say in the East, in China, not so much in South Korea or Japan, where the other industrial bases are.
So can existing charging infrastructure be used for this?
It can be upgraded. There probably need to be some retrofitting involved, but it wouldn't be, it's more the grid connections. Because you're talking about effectively doubling, or in lots of cases quadrupling, the output of each individual charger. If we're talking going from 150 or 350 watts to 350 kilowatts, and both of those is kilowatts, my apologies. It's more just an increase in grid connections for existing projects and then increasing a little bit of the hardware. No vehicles, or very, 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 very few vehicles, are going to be able to charge at this rate anyways, especially outside of China, where updating infrastructure isn't a massive concern. It just gets done, which I'm incredibly envious of. Well, I imagine there is a bit of an urban-rural dichotomy there, but let's not get too deep into that. I think moving on, so the UK has updated its carbon tax legislation. Could you explain what's going on there just a little bit?
Yeah, so essentially the UK government sat down at the back end of 2023 and concluded that it will release details of a legislation about a tax on imports based on carbon emissions. Essentially a carbon border adjustment mechanism similar to the one the EU will implement fully from end of 2025. It will be applied to sectors like aluminum, cement, ceramics, fertilizers, glass, hydrogen, iron and steel. So it covers quite a few. It's going to run in parallel to the aforementioned EU CBAM and also to the domestic version of carbon tax in the UK, which is the emissions trading system, which places a tax on domestic producers and their greenhouse gas emissions. Well, I think the interesting kind of talking point about this is something that we kind of usually rely on when we make our forecasts, especially when we make price forecasts, because the big talking point is money at the end of the day is cost, price, and the cheapest thing would always win. This is what we always say. So when it comes to green technology, to green fuels, to renewable energy against fossil fuels, we know that in today's world, these are struggling to reach cost parity with some of the carbon-based fuels available on the market. And it's exactly things like this that we're basing our forecasts on, because obviously if there's a carbon tax involved, then the UK won't be able to import either hydrogen, or we're talking about steel or iron ore or fertilizer or any of the other sectors that I mentioned. You won't be able to import those goods at the same price for much longer. This comes in operation in 2027. So what I'm trying to say is that this is an important kind of pivot point in the UK's trajectory towards net zero, because this will increase the price of a lot of carbon-based products and then bring their green alternatives into play even further.
So we're seeing this and looking at this as an accelerant?
Yeah, definitely. It's an accelerant in the right direction, coming at the right time.
That's good. How does the, say, the rates with the emissions trading scheme and the carbon border side of things in the UK compare? Mm. So if we... I'm not sure if you looked into this or not. But,
The UK CBAM, the details for it and the actual price, pounds per ton of CO2 emission, will be clarified in 2024.
Okay, right. I just know that because the European Union's CBAM mm-hmm. is based on prices from the domestic carbon market.
Yes.
There's no kind of disparity there to enforce kind of different competitive dynamics.
Sure.
Because if domestic producers paid less for carbon, then that's a way to encourage onshoring.
Yes, this is why
it's also anti-competitive, so there'd be some questions there from the... I was about to say the WHO. That's very much an organization. From the World Bank.
Yes.
With regards to anti-competitive practices. That would be clarified 2024, correct?
Yes, that's correct. In 2024, we'll know more about the price, exact price and everything. But the UK government has made it clear that this will be based on the UK ETS, the emissions trading system that's aimed at domestic producers, to make sure that, obviously, like you said, there won't be a disparity, and then this won't encourage domestic carbon emissions to grow.
Well, it's interesting. So if we think about the competitive dynamics between us, when you have both of these systems in place and functional, If you have both an emissions trading scheme, which is just a carbon tax based on what you produce and having a carbon allowance, as it were, and then you have CBAM, which is largely going to be based off of the difference between the most green produced of a certain product relative to what is produced and the difference between that, you're still encouraging lower carbon regardless. So if both of them are strict enough that they are doing a significant job in discounting fossil fuel produced products from manufacturing, then a little disparity between the two isn't necessarily the end of the world from a pure carbon perspective. Mm. Where those emissions will originate will change based on that, as you say. But if those emissions are significantly lower, does it really matter where the emissions are coming from? If we're talking about steel produced in say, either the UK or in Poland or Germany, and then imported from elsewhere, as long as the logistics is accounted for, which it should be under CBAM, I believe. It's all measured and it's all accounted for based on kind of exports and such.
Sure, I mean it's hard to pinpoint.
From a political perspective, you don't want the emissions arising from you. So if the UK can get away with importing them and then saying, "Oh no, these emissions weren't us," and then lowering it, then they probably will. But from an economic point of view. God, I hate economics and politics intertwining. Yeah. You want that production here because of the employment effects.
Sure, no, I agree with you. From a political point of view, you wouldn't want this to backfire, and you want to protect your domestic emissions, or rather not, you know, avoid increasing them. But from an economic point of view, things are quite complicated because both of those legislations, the domestic one and the import one, will kind of have their own markets, and those things will dictate the price, because when it comes to the emission trading system, it's essentially the government has a set number of allowances, so to say, for carbon emissions that domestic producers can purchase. But this will reduce by about 45% between 2023 and 2027. And will keep on decreasing, so then there'll be less and less available on the market, less and less for people to buy, so the prices will increase. So whether it will be more economic to produce something domestically if you have the option instead of importing it, because the domestic carbon tax it's lower than the imported carbon tax, that's really too complicated to say at this point in time.
It's a balancing mechanism, isn't it? It's something that some people are probably going to try to work it out, but
yeah.
At the same time, it's not going to be that simple, as you say, as opposed to... Well, this is why Europe is basing their CBAM off of their domestic carbon pricing system, so that they change in step, and there isn't a significant competitive difference, at least not one built into the algorithmic trading of the system.
Yeah. But I mean, so, you know, all things aside, economics aside, will reduce carbon emissions. So yeah. It's a step in the right direction.
It's an accelerant, a complicated one, but an accelerant nonetheless.
A necessary one.
Incredibly, incredibly necessary. Moving on, speaking of necessary and market mechanisms, Angola has left OPEC Plus rather suddenly, following what it claimed to be... So the country's oil minister effectively said... OPEC Plus is no longer fit for our needs, and so we are leaving. Now, this wasn't based on production quotas for Angola, because Angola is already producing the maximum it can produce. It doesn't have any more spare capacity as of right now with regards to oil production. It was a complaint on production quotas with regards to effectively Saudi and Russia's leadership of the bloc, in that it can't maintain oil prices at the level that Angola desires. And so Angola left. That's not going to change the oil prices, but it does reduce OPEC power in the market even further. That's mostly theoretical, because as of right now, Angola can't change, well, it has no reason to change its production output. Any reductions recently through OPEC have been from Russia and Saudi Arabia, because they produce by far the most in the bloc, and still have kind of room to wind down production in favor of higher prices, opposed to other countries which produce less, where if they reduced output in the same amount, it would cripple their production and then effectively government revenues from a set period. So unless you want to cause economic collapse among your members, you don't want to do that except through Russia and Saudi Arabia. Whether or not this is going to start a bit of a trickle effect from other countries leaving, as of right now, that's quite unlikely. Other countries could leave, but it will mostly be the small players. We don't see any significant movement from any of the major producers within the bloc. This does bring OPEC Plus down to 12 members, though Equatorial Guinea is looking to join somewhat soon. They don't produce all that much oil, so from a pure capacity perspective, it's not a significant change. And Brazil also plans on joining soon, but they don't intend to take part in the bloc's production quota mechanism.
What's the incentive for joining OPEC Plus?
Communication within the group. Brazil's in a bit of a weird spot since the election, so they've had the kind of left wing, more socialist individual win. I believe this was Lula. I covered this last year near the end of it. And he's generally quite an environmentalist. He's incredibly pro the support of the Amazon, and because Bolsonaro did his best to appease cattle farmers in the country and allowed them to cut down large swaths of it and completely, working to destroy the Amazon's rather crucial role as a carbon sink. Mm. And I believe Lula has been at least a little bit better in that regard since taking office, though he is a little bit hamstrung by the internal politics of the situation. Unless that's changed recently, I've not had too much time to check, but I don't believe so. So regardless, the reason that a country would like to join OPEC would be that they have some reason to desire high or at least very stable oil prices. Mm. But in the last decade or so, OPEC Plus's market share of the oil market has decreased from 34% to 27%. A 20% drop over 10 years isn't particularly... It's bad, but it's not that bad in the grand scheme of things. The problem is, if it lowers any further, it can spiral. It's because OPEC Plus's validity and its reason for existing is to have control over the oil market and oil prices. And so, if more countries leave and that 27 drops to 22, 25, then it has a bit of a problem because it no longer has as much of an incentive for other countries to join, apart from the particularly large producers, which, when you're talking about large producers of oil, outside of Saudi and Russia, the other producers tend to be quite antagonistic towards these two individuals. So the United States, its oil production is at an all-time high, mostly because of shale fracking. That has pretty royally screwed over any attempts by Russia and Saudi to keep a price floor in the price of oil. And so they're not going to be interested in joining OPEC Plus. They have no reason to. Their production is already high enough and they don't want to abide by any quotas. That's one of the other issues with it. Any large producers don't want to be bound by production quotas if they're already producing at a maximum capacity. Mm. You're just reducing your own production capacity in favor of slightly higher oil prices, which mostly benefit other countries, rather than you. If you can already dictate the price of oil, why would you join somebody else who tells you how to do it, when you can do it to yourself most beneficially? What I'm saying is, this is a continuation of the slow decline of OPEC, and as Peter once said, it's going to happen much, much faster than anybody else is going to realize. This is just, I wouldn't say it's a domino, but this is a stepping stone up towards the domino. Because it's not creating a cascading effect as of yet. When Angola left, there was a slight dip in the price of oil, and the price of oil right now is at about $70 or $75, depending on where you are in the world.
Oh.
Per barrel. That's pretty low for this time of year. Actually, for this time of year, it's not too bad. But Russia and Saudi wanted it to be higher sooner, and they failed in doing so and have reduced production capacity going into the new year as a result of that. While they have spare capacity to increase, that doesn't help them as of right now because it would just crash the price of oil. What I'm saying is, OPEC Plus's influence is steadily reduced, not just because of the increase in electric vehicle sales, which increases electric vehicles in the active fleet, which reduces oil production, but also because countries and participants in OPEC Plus are becoming increasingly disenfranchised with how it's run and its impact. It's a bit like having a bad manager. You see this individual doing things wrong, and you want to leave. Or you at least see the effects of what they're doing. And they may be doing all the right things, but if it's still negative, it's going to look as if the leaders are doing something wrong. And so, you no longer wish to take part. You think, I can do better on my own, or at least I'm not going to be... You look at it and say, okay, if it's going to go wrong, it'll be on my terms, and I'll do what I can to stave off any negative effects, as opposed to remaining part of OPEC and going down with the ship, as it were. Moving on, just a couple of short items in this week's issue. There was a lot of news over the Christmas period from NEO, so I'd just like to go over that as I did bring it up earlier. So, a piece of news that Andreas would have found interesting is that NEO has signed a partnership with one of the major solar developers in Longi. I believe, one of the top three solar producers in the world. Andreas would be able to correct me on that. That will see NEO's fourth generation swapping stations, each equipped with 60 square meters of solar panels. Now, each solar station is expected to generate about 18 megawatt hours. It didn't actually give a time period, so again, I'd have to ask Andreas. And both companies will also be partnering with regards to integrating vehicle-to-grid technologies from the swapping stations, which I think is very interesting. And honestly, the main part of this, as opposed to just putting some panels on rather large shed. So, integrating vehicle-to-grid technologies in a vehicle is great, but that's one battery. If you have a vehicle swapping station, that is going to need to contain a larger bank of other batteries, which are charged during off-peak periods. This is particularly suitable for vehicle-to-grid, because during peak periods of electricity demand aren't necessarily going to correlate with peak periods of battery-swapping vehicle demand. If NEO is able to supply to the grid through its battery-swapping stations, it effectively just has a BESS project. A relatively small one in the order of megawatt hours, yes. But it's still a significant asset to have use of when it comes to grid firming and addressing intermittency. So, NEO's battery swapping stations aren't just battery swapping stations with this partnership. And with the look towards vehicle-to-grid technology, they're also battery energy storage investments. Admittedly based on LFP, which, well, actually not necessarily based on LFP, but NEO also filed in December to be able to use LFP batteries in its vehicles. Up until now, it had primarily used NMC, because it was aiming towards the luxury end of the market, and with the battery swapping system, you can manage the degradation a lot better. So you can cycle them out, you can cycle different batteries into different vehicles and properly address it that way. So, but its movement towards LFP batteries means that battery swap stations / energy storage systems, which is what they will effectively become with vehicle-to-grid technology, is that it will be more effective, it will be a much, much better investment than a large NMC battery bank would be when you use LFP batteries, just because the lifespans usually at least double, if not closer to triple, in terms of overall, in terms of total charge cycles. So, there is more NEO news, but we should probably give that a little bit of a rest. Anything interesting on your end?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about Vestas, the wind turbine manufacturer, released a lot of news about firm orders in December. Almost 10 gigawatts in orders announced just in December, just in time for Christmas. So I'm not really sure if Santa Claus is building a couple of wind turbines or anything related to that.
God, those poor elves. So I'm seeing 4.2 gigawatts in the UK from Vattenfall. That's a significant chunk of that. 1 gigawatt from Pattern Energy. I saw something about their financing. Yeah. Yeah, they secured $11 billion in financing for the construction of the Sunsia line, wind and transmission project. That's $11 billion. So that's a big, big jump. Very good for the US. And then lots of smaller projects in the range of 40 megawatts to about almost a gigawatt. Pretty much worldwide. In South Africa, more in the US, Germany, Lithuania, Spain. Interesting. Now, what's the reason for this, do you think? So, we know that the wind industry has been going through a bit of a rough patch. Is this to inspire confidence in the company? Because that's the only reason I can really that's the immediate reason that comes to the top of my mind as to why Vestas would publish this. Because otherwise, it doesn't really gain. It looks like a confidence measure.
I mean, it's, you know, I think from an investor point of view and from the public point of view, you know, you release all these firm orders, you're pretty sure that Vestas will be alive for years to come and is a healthy company. So I think it's a, I don't know if it's a bit of a flex or you know, insurance for, or rather reassurance for investors.
I think it's more so the latter. I think while it is a bit of a flex of here's our firm orders, nobody else can meet this, it's also here's our firm orders, please don't run away. We see the state of the wind industry.
It might be. I mean, I don't know, because if you think about it, the wind industry has been slow, so how soon will Vestas actually be able to build all this?
Well, that's not really Vestas' problem, as long as it's as long as it remains profitable.
Sure, but what I'm trying to say is I don't know if they kind of shot themselves in the foot with this, because surely all these clients are thinking, well, we're not the only one putting an order in. What's the likelihood of our order to not be bottlenecked by some supply chain issue? And then everything gets delayed again, so...
That's a good point. It's saying these are our firm orders is also pretty much saying this is what we are going to be delivering upon. So if it falls short by any margin, it's going to look pretty bad in hindsight. Anyways, I think that that should be enough for this week's episode of the Rethink Energy Podcast. Again, these stories are all based upon what we've written for our weekly issue, which you can find on rethinkresearch.biz, that's .biz, every Wednesday. And with that, I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again. I would encourage you all to check out our first episode of the Rethink Energy Talks series, which we're going to be interviewing individuals from the renewable energy industry and adjacent industries, just in the interview style that we would do internally, just to find out information, but with companies that are happy to release this information into the public. So check that out if you haven't already, because there's going to be more to come quite soon. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for listening, and we'll see you again next week.